If you were here last week, I know most of you were, you recall I was trying to get to the Great Tribulation, which lies toward the end of what's called the Olivet Discourse. The Olivet Discourse, as I'm sure most of you are aware, is Jesus' treatise on the cataclysm. Many people would say it's his treatise on the end of the world, but it may very well be rather his treatise on the end of the age. That is the Old Covenant age. That's the approach I'm taking. I think it's a perfectly allowable approach, especially in terms of classic Christian theology, even though typically you'll find people usually assign it to the end of the world, you see, kind of describing the end time and so on. So that's part of the discussion we're having. What I was attempting to develop at that point was all of the preamble that leads up to a discussion of the Great Tribulation. Jesus points out to his disciples these great buildings. He says, "Do you see these great buildings?" Which means particular buildings, you know, in history. And he says, concerning those buildings, which he adds, "that you now see, I tell you, one stone will not be left upon another till all of this is devastated," you know. And that, of course, triggers in the minds of the disciples a great concern, because how could this be that these great edifices that have been constructed there, the temple and all the beautiful surroundings, etc., would be destroyed? And they raised that question, when will these things be, you see, and what, when will, in fact, they use that term, the ponta tata, when will all these things take place, and what will be the sign of your coming? And so Jesus then proceeds to give them what has been called the Olivet Discourse, because it was given on the Mount of Olives. And he begins to spell out the seven signs. We looked at these briefly last week. Seven separate signs of the close of the age. And I was attempting in a very abbreviated way to point out to you that every one of those seven signs took place in the first century. And we find New Testament evidence for every one of them, including the sign that the gospel would be preached to the entire world. There's several texts in the New Testament that tell us it was preached to the entire world, you see. And I spent some time on that, and then the time ran out. So I wanted to get you up now to where we were looking at the Great Tribulation. After those seven signs, Jesus says this, and we're at verse, let's say, 19 of Matthew 24, and it says this, "But woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing babies in those days, and pray that your flight," and by that he means your flight from Jerusalem, "may not be in the winter or on the Sabbath. For then there will be great tribulation, such as has not been since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor ever shall be." And of course the text goes on, but that's where you have this reference then. Again, another one in Luke, to this great tribulation. And of course you hear a great deal of commentary suggesting that is yet to come. However, there's been a respectable school of thought throughout church history which would say, no, the great tribulation that Jesus is talking about there is the tribulation connected with the great judgment that came to bear against Israel in general and Jerusalem in particular, and that it was at that point that we have this massive outpouring of wrath and the horrible things that took place at that time. Now, a common theory would be this, and I've heard this many times, people will say, well, this is a case of a dual fulfillment, you know, if you're familiar with that, the idea that this, indeed there was a great tribulation in the first century, but in fact there will be a greater tribulation later in history. You see, that's a theory. You find that in the Bible. We heard read this morning the text, "Unto you a child is born, unto you a son is given." That's a statement from Isaiah. But as we all know, there was a greater child born. A greater son was given, of whom in a greater sense the government of the world would rest on his shoulders. And that's what we celebrate, obviously, at Christmas time, a dual fulfillment. Well, people say the same thing applies to the Great Tribulation. There was a great tribulation in the first century, but there'll be a greater tribulation at the end of history, you see, which would be a plausible hypothesis were it not for the fact that Jesus himself rules it out. Verse 20, when he says, verse 21, "For then there will be great tribulation such as has not been at the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor ever shall be." You see. Now, when Jesus says it's unprecedented in history and unrepeatable in future history, you got to take that seriously. I mean, when the text itself rules out that there would ever be anything like it again, then we're forced, I think, to at least say this: there's only one. Now, whether this is it or not is obviously a question we can talk about, but let's not labor. In other words, if the text itself rules out a dual fulfillment, then I think it's irresponsible of us to suggest that there's going to be a dual fulfillment, in contradiction, you see, to what the text itself is strongly suggesting. Now, classically, the view has been, and again, I can't say classically in the sense of unanimously, but I would say a very respectable school of thought in history has been that what's being described here is all of the Holocaust that was poured out in Jerusalem. Josephus gives a gruesome, blood-curdling, detailed analysis of it, of course, in his writings. And it all is very much in keeping with what Moses had predicted would happen back in the book of Deuteronomy chapter 28. I don't want to go into a detail of what happened in Jerusalem because I did that last year. And many of you were in the class I did on the Apocalypse last year, in which I read extensively from Josephus and other sources about these events. Those tapes still exist somewhere out there in the ethos. So I hope you can, if you're interested in wading through all of that, then more power to you, because they do exist. And if you're having trouble finding them, then by all means, I'd be glad to help you with that. But the point is that there was this incredible, you see, horrible circumstance there in the first century. It's very well detailed by various ancient scholars, I should say ancient historians. And there's perfectly good reason to see that as really fulfilling exactly what Jesus said. I'll leave that theme at that point, even though I'm sure it probably would be worth a much more extended discussion. But I'd like to move then to the end of the Olivet Discourse and the next subject that comes up, which has to do with this idea of Christ coming on the clouds. Now listen, I'm going to read to you beginning at verse 29 of Matthew 24. Listen to what Jesus says. Immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light. The stars will fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then the sign of the Son of Man in heaven will appear, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he will send his angels, his angeloi, messengers, with a great sound of a trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of the heaven to the other. Now, learn this parable from the fig tree. When its branch is already become tender and puts forth leaves, you know that summer is near. So you also, when you see all these things, know that it is near, right at the doors. Assuredly, I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words by no means will pass away. Now, I hope you see the dilemma there. I could probably recite to you at least a half a dozen different ways that that text has been handled. Now, someone's been mutilated, you know. But it's a tough nugget, because I think you can see, on its face, Jesus is obviously saying that generation there in the first century would not pass away till all these things were fulfilled. I've heard people play with, what does he mean by all these things? Maybe what he meant was not all those things, but most of those things, you see. Maybe that generation was not that generation, but some other generation way off in the future, and this and that. But the problem is, if in fact we postulate that all those things happened in the first generation, did the sun darken? Did the moon not give its light? Did the stars fall from the heaven? You see? And I think you can see, it almost forces people, and I've heard people say, well, Jesus just made a mistake. That's a slick way out of that one, you know. The Lord of the church, the King of the universe, the one who says, I am truth, goofed, you know. I don't know what that does to your faith, but I'd like to at least take a second glance before I just, you know, kind of gratuitously take that position that maybe Jesus just got it wrong. So anyway, bear with me now, because I'm going to dare to take the position that has been taken by some of the, not that I'm one of them, but some of the greatest thinkers in the church who have said Jesus meant what he said, and that in fact every single solitary thing he mentioned actually happened, including the sun darkening, etc. Now, that may seem preposterous to you right now, but I'm just asking you to play ball with me for a little bit and see whether that might actually be the case. Let's at least note this. Jesus begins the discussion by using the word immediately, you see. Immediately, and he ties it to the Great Tribulation. Immediately after the tribulation of those days, these things will take place. And if, in fact, that tribulation took place in the first century, I don't know of any way with a straight face we can say that immediately meant 2,000 years down the road. That Jesus seems to tie it together rather closely, and that Greek word euthus, immediately, means immediately in time. And so, you know, if that word is given its ordinary sense, then that simply seems to be, what we're forced to think about here, let alone what Jesus said about that generation. All right, here's the critical point. Jesus comes to Israel, obviously, as the Messiah, the Son of God, and all of that, but one of the roles that he plays as he comes to Israel is the role of the prophet. He is prophet, priest, and king. And as prophet, Jesus functioned in many ways the same way that Old Testament prophets functioned, using the same kind of vocabulary and language and descriptive kinds of expressions to communicate ideas. There's virtually nothing that Jesus said in terms of this prophetic role that had not been said, or I might say language he used that had not been used by other prophets at earlier times. Jesus uses standard prophetic vocabulary, which was understood by the people of his day immediately because they were steeped in the Old Testament. They had memorized these texts. These were commonplace ways of expressing things to them, which tend to be foreign to us. But it's largely foreign to us because we don't know our Old Testaments the way they did. And so we read these things and don't appreciate, you might say, the poetic or prophetic flavor that is present there in the way that his first century hearers would have immediately recognized it. That's a criticism of us, that we're not having the ears to hear, you see, the language that's being used. Let me just give you a few illustrations of that, hopefully to suggest the point. First of all, Jesus talks about the sun being darkened, the moon not giving its light, and the stars falling from the heaven. This is not the first time in Israel's history that prophets had used that language. It had been used repeatedly, you see, in Old Testament history. Many occasions when prophets came to Israel and said language like that, and every time they used it, they were referring not to cosmic, you see, collapses. They were referring to the collapse of great political empires every time. Now, the reason for that is because in the book of Genesis, back in Eden, as we mentioned a few weeks ago, the stars, the sun, the moon were said to be governing or stand for governing powers. And so this is picking up a theme from Eden and using it to poetically express an idea of the collapse of powers. Now, let me give you a couple of illustrations. This is Isaiah. In Isaiah chapter 13, and he is describing here the fall of Babylon as a political empire. Okay? Isaiah describing the fall of Babylon as a political empire, Isaiah 13, beginning around verse 9 and 10. Quote, "For the stars of heaven and their constellations will not give their light. The sun will be darkened in its going forth. The moon will not cause its light to shine." There's Isaiah describing the fall of Babylon. We've got Isaiah describing the fall of political Edom, you see. And he says this in chapter 34. "All the hosts of heaven shall be dissolved, and the heavens will be rolled up like a scroll." Describing the fall of Edom. Amos describes the fall of Samaria, the northern 10 tribes that were carried away into captivity in 722 under Assyrian authority. This is what he says. This Amos describing the fall of Samaria. Quote, And it shall come to pass on that day, says the Lord, I will make the sun go down at noon. I will darken the earth in broad daylight. You see. Here's Ezekiel describing the fall of Egypt in Ezekiel 32. Quote, when I put out your light, I will cover the heavens, and the stars will be dark. I will cover the sun with a cloud, and the moon will not give her light. All the bright lights of the heavens I will make dark, and darkness will cover the land. And I'm just giving you a sampling. You know, go look this up in your concordance at home and see how many times the prophets are describing the collapse of political authority by referring to the collapse of these heavenly, celestial beings. It never happened that the sun was darkened. You understand that? When Samaria was hauled off into captivity, the sun did not go dark, literally. But figuratively it did, you see. And that's the point. That's the way the prophets use that. It's interesting that Peter quotes Joel on the day of Pentecost. In fact, Dr. Bruner was suggesting you go home and read some text. Well, I'm going to add an addendum to the assignment, a good Sabbath day reading. Go home and read Acts chapter 2, but thinking about it in connection with what we're talking about this morning. Read Acts chapter 2, and especially Peter's sermon on the day of Pentecost, in which he's telling the people who are confused what the meaning is of these things that are happening. And Peter says, one way of understanding it is to understand that this is that which was spoken by the prophet Joel. What you are seeing here today, you inhabitants of Jerusalem, is what Joel predicted would occur. And here's what Joel said. I'm not going to read the whole quote, but listen to this language from Joel, which is quoted by Peter on the day of Pentecost as the explanation of what they're seeing in these people speaking in tongues and so on. This is what he says, quote, I will show wonders in heaven above and signs in the earth beneath, blood and fire and vapor of smoke. The sun will be turned into darkness and the moon into blood, you see, before the coming of the great and awesome day of the Lord. What Peter is saying is that the events that are set in motion today and are going to be playing out in this generation will finally reach that awesome conclusion, you know, in connection with the very events you're hearing of here, that the sun will be darkened. Well, the sun was never darkened in that sense, but the sun of Israel was darkened. The moon did turn to blood, you see, in connection with the events that took place there in Israel. So anyway, if you get that point, really everything that Jesus says here can be understood in connection with the Old Testament vocabulary. That's what I'm laboring with you at this point. I hope you don't feel like what I'm trying to do here. I've been accused of this. It's just, oh, you're just trying to explain it away. For the life of me, this hopefully is not explaining it away. Just the opposite, you see. But obviously, if I'm going to speak to you in a language, then it's helpful for us to be both speaking the same language. And if Jesus is using prophetic oracle statements here, you see, that would be typical of Old Testament prophets, he would take it for granted that the people hearing him would hear him in the canons of that kind of literary definition and understanding. I don't think any person knowing the Old Testament who heard Jesus say those words in the Olivet Discourse would have interpreted him to mean that the sun would actually be darkened, because they would have immediately thought of texts they memorized years ago, from Isaiah and Ezekiel and Amos and others, and understood it that way. Only when Jesus used it, what political empire was he talking about, you know, the lights going out on? You see, in that case, it was Israel. Israel would be the nation that the cataclysm would come to, and the sun would go out and the moon would be darkened. Jesus also says this. He says there will be the sign of the Son of Man. This sometimes is translated to suggest that the sign would be in heaven. Actually, if you read the Greek, I won't take time to put this on the board. I thought of it, but time is running away from me anyway. But if you actually look at the language of the Greek here that we find in Matthew's Gospel, it's clear that the sign is not necessarily in heaven. It's the way it reads is it's the sign, then will appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven, you see. In other words, there will be a sign of the Son of Man being in heaven, which is to say a sign that he is on his throne. That's the whole concept, that Christ ascended to his heavenly throne and now has under him all principalities, powers, mights, and dominions. as Isaiah had predicted, on his shoulders are the governments of the world. He is the ruler of the kings of the universe. You see, he is the one who is on the throne. And how do we know that? What was the sign? What was the vindication of the reign of Christ? Well, the sign of his reign were these events that happened on earth. This was the vindication of the Lamb. He'd been murdered in Jerusalem 40 years earlier. Now was, as Revelation tells us, the time of the wrath of the Lamb against that city which had murdered him. Now came the judgment back, you see. So that'd be the idea there. We also have this reference to the clouds of heaven, the Son of Man coming on the clouds. Now again, I touched on this last week, and so in light of that fact, I don't want to labor it much longer here. But I'll just remind you that this little phrase we hear again and again in the New Testament, the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven, would be taken by the people who heard him as an echo of Daniel chapter 7, where we read that very language. The Son of Man came on the clouds of heaven. But as we noticed at that time, where was it that the Son of Man came to? Now, what was his destination, you see? And of course, the destination in Daniel 7 was this was the Son of Man coming to his throne. He was coming to the, in that language, Ancient of Days. And he was given dominion and power and a kingdom that would never end, you see. That's Daniel 7. And when we read in the New Testament about the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven, we must be very cautious, lest we immediately jump to the conclusion this is talking about the second coming. It's a perfectly legitimate understanding of it to be in connection with Daniel 7, where he's coming to his throne, coming to his position of authority. Not the end of Christian history, but the beginning of it, you see. That would be perfectly permissible in connection with what's there in the Old Testament. So again, this idea of the clouds of heaven has that notion. Let me add this, though, about this description of Christ coming on the clouds or God coming on the clouds of heaven. We see that many times in the Old Testament, again, where there is a description of God coming on the clouds, you see. If you want to look at some texts, I won't read them all, but just you might want to jot them down. Psalm 104, verse 3. Isaiah 19, Nahum chapter 1, verse 3, and there's others. You might just look up clouds in your concordance, and you'll find some others as well. And you'll read many times of the idea that God comes on clouds, you see. This is not unprecedented, therefore. It's an Old Testament figure. What happens when God comes on the clouds? Usually it means he's coming in a kind of dual function there. He's coming on the one hand in judgment, typically, and at the same time with salvation. Maybe the best example of this would be the Exodus. When the children of Israel come out of Egypt, God comes on clouds, literally in that case, you see. And the clouds are a judgment against Egypt, confusing them. But they are salvation for Israel, protecting them. Salvation and judgment, the clouds, you see. And anytime you see that idea of God coming on clouds, you'll frequently find that those two themes are present. Judgment against the unbelievers with salvation for those who are obeying God. And again, for Christ to say, the Son of Man comes on the clouds, would be a way of suggesting the same idea, that there is a salvation and a judgment that are coming. Well, in the first century, God came on the clouds big time, you see, to Israel. It was a time of salvation for the people of God when they were liberated from the tyranny that had been perpetrated against them in Jerusalem all those years. And at the same time, it was a judgment against the city that had been responsible for that persecution that they had sustained. So anyway, there's a thought on that one that you might want to give some attention to. Finally, we have Jesus mentioning gathering the elect. He says he'll send his angeloi, translated angels, out to gather the elect. The word angeloi, typically translated angels, but actually means messengers, may or may not refer to heavenly beings. Frequently in the New Testament does not, actually refers to earthly people, human beings. For example, in, threw this away, Matthew 11, you might look at these, Luke chapter 7, Luke chapter 9, and also in Revelation when we hear about the angels of the seven churches, very likely those are the pastors of those churches. Human beings who are called angels, but they are human beings in a messenger role, you see, and other texts as well. So in other words, what I'm saying is that just because you hear the word angelos or angeloi, angels, doesn't necessarily imply a heavenly being. In this connection, it would probably be saying that with the destruction of Jerusalem, the Christian message was catapulted to the world. And the preachers of the gospel, the angels, as it were, of the gospel, went around the world gathering his elect, you see, from every end of the universe. An interesting word that's used here, it says that he gathers them. The Greek word is synago, which is the root of the Greek word synagoge, or synagogue. And it's a very interesting little play on words, that these angels are going out to synagogue the elect of God, as if to create a new synagogue of the elect. Because, of course, up until that time, the synagogue had been associated with Judaism. But now Judaism had repudiated her Messiah and become, as John says in Revelation, the synagogue of Satan. You know, they had tried to give you the Father while denying the Son. And by virtue of doing that, had ceased to be a true synagogue of the people of God. They still held services, still got together, still, you know, did the business of the synagogue, but the judgment of Christ against them was they had become a synagogue of Satan. That's in the letter to the Philadelphians and the letter to the Smyrnans in the seven letters to the seven churches in the Apocalypse. Well, where's the new synagogue? Well, here are these preachers, these messengers going out and synagoguing the elect, as if to say, here's the new greater synagogue, you see, that now replaces the old, just as there's a new Jerusalem that comes on replacing the old, you see, a new people of God that replaces the old. So anyway, I'd like to spend more time on that. I'm just trying to give you a sense of how this text has been viewed historically. I'm not trying to deny, you see, that there is a last chapter to be written. I'm just saying that some of what we have tied to the last chapter, we may have done that mistakenly. And especially in connection with the Olivet Discourse, it's probably worth rethinking that. Let me take a moment or two and talk about the Antichrist. I'd like to give you a bit of a preamble on this one. First of all, what we commonly hear is that the Antichrist is a figure that will rise up at the end of history and be associated, presumably, with a one-world government, and Christians will be, you know, persecuted and all of that. And so that's the model that tends to be the popular notion of Antichrist out there in the culture. Again, all I want to do is ask the question, what do we actually read in the Scriptures about the Antichrist? What do we read? What's actually there? But let me give you a little bit of a backdrop before we focus on that. First of all, bear in mind that Jesus himself in the Olivet Discourse predicted that in this last generation there would be a massive outbreaking of apostasy even from within the Christian church. That is to say that even people who had apparently come to Christ would fall away in big numbers, you see, and that there would actually be an outbreak of heresy. And in fact, there was a major threat to the church in its pristine time there, both by radical outbreaks of heresy all over the place and by major apostate movements from within the Christian church. We tend to look at that as in a sort of naive way, viewing the early church as very, you know, alive and well and things were wonderful and so on. But if you read the New Testament, you realize that the church of the first generation of Christians had some major problems, and that's what precipitated a lot of those letters, was counteracting some of the profound problems that were taking place within the churches. Most of the threat that was coming to the church was coming through Judaism, especially early on. The Judaizing movement there, which was attempting, in a sense, to seduce Christians to amalgamate their Christian faith with some species or other of Jewish practice. That was the principal problem that was under discussion in Acts 15, as you know, the first great so-called ecumenical council of the church. They got together to deal with that issue. You know, are we going to require new converts to the Christian faith to be circumcised and to obey the law of Moses? In other words, reducing Christianity to a sect of Judaism. Or is this Christian faith actually going to stand on its own two feet? The book of Galatians was written almost in its entirety to address this problem of the Judaizing threat within the church. The book of Hebrews, the same thing. And peppered throughout the New Testament, we have major concerns about the threat to the church, largely at the hands of the Judaizing influence. Paul warned in Acts chapter 20 that after he left, this was to the Ephesian church, that wolves would come in and scatter the flock, you see. That was his fear, and his prayer for them would be that they'd be protected. If you read the New Testament, you see there were all kinds of heresies running around. There were people who were saying the resurrection had already occurred, that is, the resurrection of all the saints. There were those who denied that there would be a resurrection. You see that in 1 Corinthians. You see in Colossians asceticism and angel worship, you see, being promoted in the church. You see rampant immorality and rebellion here and there at times in the church's history, in the early church's history. Hebrews, you see, has stern warnings against those who were tempted to go back into some sort of Judaism. Now, it's that I want you to have in your mind when you think about Antichrist. Antichrist is a term that is never used in the book of Revelation, which many times comes to people as a surprise. It never occurs in the book of Revelation. It's pure speculation to tie Antichrist itself to any particular figure. Usually it's tied to the so-called beast of chapter 13, one of those two. There's two beasts there, you know. But that's speculation. There's nothing in Revelation to give us warrant. And that's a little bit surprising because the only author in the New Testament who uses the term Antichrist is John, who is presumably the author of Revelation. And had he wanted to make that connection, he certainly could have, since he was writing the book, you know. And yet he declines to do that. We also do not find the term Antichrist in the Gospel of John. So the two major works by John, who is the only person that uses the term, Paul never uses it, the only guy that ever uses the term, declines to use it, both in Revelation and in the Gospel. The only place he uses it is in his first and second epistles, you see. He uses it in chapter 2. He uses the term in chapter 4 of 1 John, and then in verses 7 through 11 of 2 John. Now, again, just read them, you know, and ask yourself, if this is all you have to go on and what the Antichrist is, what conclusions would you draw? I'm going to give you some suggestions. I'm not trying to spoon-feed you this. I think you should be, you know, good enough Bible students to go and read these verses on your own, so I highly recommend you do it. But I'd like to suggest to you, I think these are at least some of the things that we'd have to infer from these texts about the nature of Antichrist. Number one, Christians of that day had been warned that Antichrist was coming and were advised in 1 John that now Antichrist is here. You see. Just as you've been warned that he is coming, or it is coming, Antichrist, so now it is here. There are many Antichrists, you see, running loose. That's at least one thing that we gather from the text in 1 John. That Antichrist was already at work, we hear of in 1 John. If you read these closely, you realize that there are many Antichrists. John doesn't seem to locate it in one person in particular, but he does talk about many who seem to represent whatever Antichrist tended to be. I think if you read those texts, the impression one draws from them is that Antichrist, more than being concentrated in a person, could very well be understood as a movement or a system of belief that principally stood for this idea. You can have the Father without the Son. Antichrist, you see. And the movement of that century that was saying you can have the Father without the Son was largely the Jewish movement that was attempting to compete with the idea that Christ is exclusively the way to God. And so John says, the person who says that Messiah did not come in the flesh, this is the Antichrist. Those who are running around saying that the Messiah is not, you see, a reality, did not come to us in the flesh, that's the Antichrist. And that's how John identifies it. Now, again, I realize that flies in the face of an awful lot of popular sentiment. And you may feel like, boy, I'm way out on a real, you know, thin ice here to be saying something like this. And all I'm doing is just pleading with you, let's just go back and see what the book says on the subject, and not so much what a lot of, you know, commentators are suggesting. Let's just find what's in the book. Because that's really what we're bound to, you know. And if we don't find all of the elaborate, you know, kinds of descriptions of this person that just has this astonishing worldwide power associated with, if we don't find that actually suggested in the New Testament, then maybe we should just rethink that point a little bit. That's all I'm, you know, arguing for. And so you can take that for whatever you may think it's worth. Let me move in the last 5 minutes or so to the last theme that I want to treat here, which is this use of the term the last days. Again, we hear in the New Testament a great deal, the term is used rather frequently, of the last days. And our sort of knee-jerk reaction to that is that it must be referring to the last days of the world, you know. That's what that term is all about. And again, I just want to suggest to you for your reflection that the last days may, at least in some occasions, in fact probably must, in some occasions, be referring not to the last days of the world, but to the last days of Israel. This was a Jewish community, you see, that was receiving these letters. They were Jewish. And even if they'd converted to the Christian faith, they were still steeped in their own Jewish heritage. And their whole sense of stability of the whole universe was related to Israel and Jerusalem and the temple. All of these things kind of stood for the reign and rule of God and his authority in the universe and so on. They had a very geographically, you know, localized kind of understanding in their faith. And you can understand what a tumultuous thing it would be for them to envision now the end of that, the end of that era, the end of an age, you see, that had spanned hundreds and hundreds of years. And for them to think and use the term the last days and mean the last days of that age would be a perfectly understandable usage of that term. You see, that's what we're saying. So, for example, we find Peter again on the day of Pentecost quoting from Joel. And this is, now Peter's addressing the people there on the day of Pentecost, and he uses this kind of statement. He quotes from Joel and he says this, "It shall come to pass in the last days, says God, that I will pour out my spirit on all flesh. Your sons and your daughters will prophesy. Your young men will see visions. Your old men will dream dreams." And then Peter immediately goes into all of that stuff we read earlier about the sun being darkened and so on, you see. Now here's Peter interpreting the day of Pentecost as being, as having the earmarks of the last days. It'll be in the last days that I'll do these things. Now sometimes people say, well, the last days have been going on for 2,000 years. I mean, it started there in Pentecost, and we're still in the last days. And, well, okay, that's theoretically possible. You know, maybe the whole Christian age for 2,000 years has been the, quote, last days, and maybe the last days will continue for another couple of thousand years. Who knows? That's a theoretical possibility. But if you read that whole quote from Peter and understand the kind of pronouncements he's making there concerning Jerusalem and Israel, and especially in connection with the Olivet Discourse, I'd at least like you to try on for size the idea that when Peter was speaking of the last days, which he expressly, you know, does, maybe he meant the last days of that system of religion. While it may have been very much the first days, you see, of the Christian era, and the last days of one overlapping slightly the first days of the Christian church coming on the scene. An interesting thing is going on in the sermon that Peter preaches there. The people are disturbed because they hear the phenomenon of speaking in tongues. You see, they are there in Jerusalem, and all of a sudden people are speaking in tongues. And the folks hearing them are saying, what does this mean? Now, we tend to miss a lot of the significance of that. You know, and of course, with the contemporary charismatic and Pentecostal movements, we've gotten an awful lot of interesting baggage now associated with speaking in tongues. But we go back and ask again, what does the New Testament actually tell us about the significance of speaking in tongues? It doesn't tell us a lot. But Paul gives us one important insight in 1 Corinthians 14. When he says, this is about verse 28, in fact, I may be off on that. Let's see. Let me give you the exact reference here. Can I do it? It's somewhere in 1 Corinthians 14, 21. That's where it is. 1 Corinthians 14, 21. He says this. He says, tongues are a sign to unbelievers. You see. The significance of that phenomenon was it was a sign of judgment to unbelievers. On the day of Pentecost, when people started speaking in tongues, the significance of that was this. Up until that moment in history, the holy language was Hebrew. The holy place was Jerusalem. The holy, it was Mount Zion, the holy city, the holy land, and in a sense you could say the holy language. So if you wanted to truly worship God, you learned Hebrew. The Psalms were in Hebrew. The language of worship was Hebrew. What happened on the day of Pentecost? Just as Jerusalem was going to cease to be the holy place, in a sense, Hebrew would cease to be the holy language, and now it would be every tongue, tribe, language, and nation. See, now it was going to be the languages of the world. And in a sense, in a miraculous way, that was signified as both, it was like the cloud again, a judgment against Jerusalem, speaking in tongues. And at the same time, the good news for the Gentile. The languages of the world would now become the holy languages, you see. This was what Paul was saying in 1 Corinthians 14, and he quotes from Isaiah chapter 28, where Isaiah had predicted the judgment on Israel would come by those who would speak to them in other languages, you see. And that's what happened on the day of Pentecost. It was a message of judgment for Israel. And at the same time, it was good news, a message of hope, a message of gospel for the nations, speaking in tongues. And so Peter interprets it all by telling them that in the last days, that's what's going to happen. You'll have sons and daughters seeing visions, you know, dreaming dreams, etc. But the cataclysm that would occur there would be the dual message of judgment to Jerusalem, but good news for the nations. So anyway, I'm not saying every time we hear the term last days in the New Testament, it has that significance. What I'm saying is that it is a term which we shouldn't just have a knee-jerk reaction to when we see it. When Paul writes to Timothy, a young pastor in the faith, and tells him in the last days there's going to be all of this stuff going on, Timothy, so you be wise in the way you handle your ministerial role, it wouldn't have made much sense for Timothy if the last days were still 2,000 years away. You see, if this was for Timothy, then that meant Timothy was in the last days, and that's what he should be thinking about in the way that he carried on his work as a pastor there. And that's exactly what Paul did, was write to Timothy in that sort of way. All right, I hope this is food for thought for you. Like I said, I realize some of you may have sharp differences on some of this, and that's just fine. That's wonderful. I'm certainly capable of being quite wrong. I've been wrong lots of times in my life. But anyway, I do want you to know that I really am giving you here more the classical approach, not the Hal Lindsey approach, but more classic Christian history. Would be very comfortable with much of this, so I think it's at least good for us to have heard it. Next week we'll ask, is there a future for Israel? What is the meaning of the term the day of the Lord? And what is going to happen at the end of history? We'll turn our attention more from the past, which we've been